Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. It is Monday, May 16th, and I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. Today's episode of Talk Nerdy is brought to you by Atomic Insights, a unique resource for anyone interested in learning more about energy and the energy industry. For easily searchable articles, podcast episodes, and links to valuable reference material with no ads and no paywalls ever, visit atomicinsights.com. That's atomicinsights.com. And I also want to thank those of you who made Talk Nerdy possible this week, including Phil Tebear, Timothy Glover, Charles Payet, Jafe, the Honorable Husband, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Ken Pfeiffer, Brian Holden, and last but not least, Jeffrey Sewell. Remember, if you want to support the show, you can visit my website, carasantamaria.com, and there you can click through to various portals like the Patreon portal. You can also get there directly by visiting patreon.com/talknerdy and also the PayPal support button. And if you're interested in advertising on the podcast, just shoot me an email to shoptalknerdy@gmail.com. All right, guys, I'm really excited about our episode today. It has been quite a while since we've talked climate change in any serious way. It is a frequent request of you guys, the listeners, so I wanted to make sure that I gave it its due this week. So I sat down with Ben Houck. He is the creator of the website fightclimatedenial.com, a really great resource for learning more about the arguments that climate deniers make, for learning how to counter them, and for keeping up to date on climate change and climate denialism, and also policy surrounding those things. So without further ado, here he is, Ben Houck. Well, Ben, thank you so much for joining me today to Talk Nerdy.
Thank you, Cara. Thank you for having me.
Of course. I'm excited about this. So we met online, which is always fun. You meet somebody on Facebook and you realize that they're super interesting and you want to hear what they're up to. And you run the website fightclimatedenial.com.
Correct.
Climate denial. That's a big thing, right? And did you specifically choose the word denial as opposed to, I don't know, what are some of the euphemisms people are using? Skepticism, which really pisses me off.
Yes, skeptic is the one that they try to brand themselves as, but at the end of the day, it truly is denialism.
Yeah, because skepticism, by definition, is healthy, right? It's about choosing to utilize rational thinking, critical thinking, evidence-based thinking, and apply a healthy dose of kind of, I don't know, what is the euphemism for skepticism? A healthy dose of concern, of non-credulity, until there's enough evidence to support it.
Absolutely. And skepticism is a key fundamental part of science. Mm-hmm. You have somebody do an experiment and they come out with some data and they put it out there. The skepticism within the scientific community is able to actually strengthen that. Whereas denial is completely different from skepticism. Denial is when people look at a set of data and it may have backing a scientific consensus, and they just say, no, I do not believe that. They have no backing necessarily. They've just decided, I deny that that information is true or that data is correct or valid.
So I'm going to want to get into some of the common kind of talking points and some of the common things that we can learn in order to fight climate denial. But before we do that, I want to talk a little bit about the impetus for this. I think it's obvious to most people why, you know, big oil would be trying to, you know, fight climate change or the, quote, belief that climate change is true. Why is it that so many everyday people, so many people who don't have stock in big oil but have stock in having a healthier planet are so easily able to say, maybe not that it's a hoax. I think we are moving more and more away from everyday people saying it's a straight-out hoax, but saying, well, yeah, the climate might be changing, but it's not really getting warmer. Or even if it is getting warmer, it's probably not anthropogenic. Like, why do you think that everyday people are many of the people that your website is confronting?
So there's a very broad spectrum of denial out there. Mm-hmm. And it can be everything from something that's very understandable. Individuals don't want to feel as though they're responsible for some of the things that they see or that are happening in the world. You don't want to think, I'm driving my Suburban, I live this particular lifestyle, and that is having an impact on people in other parts of the globe, or it'll have an impact on my kids or their grandkids. So there is that basic subset of not wanting to take responsibility, not wanting to have that on your mind, that you're cause of that.
Yeah, it's kind of like the cognitive dissonance that we face when it's like deep down you kind of know that you're doing something bad, but...
But if you can tell yourself, maybe the science hasn't decided, or maybe they don't really know, or maybe it's not that bad, it allows you to kind of distance yourself from what's happening out there. So at the very basic level that exists, a big part of what we see out there, it does come a lot down to politics. Mm-hmm. And it comes down to not what politics used to be, but what politics is today, which is really tribalism, where you join this group and you now have to believe every single part of the platform. It's the GOP believes that climate change either isn't real, or maybe it's real, but it's not human caused. Or if it is human caused, maybe we don't really need to do something about it. Or maybe it's even good for the planet. That you have to take that stance if you're part of the party. We're seeing that change, which is a very positive thing. We're seeing, obviously, Democrats, independents have a very strong percentage of people who believe in climate change, mm-hmm. and believe that it's man-made and believe that we need to do something about it. The Republican side, it's growing. And now it's actually a majority of Republican individuals do believe in it.
Oh, that's good.
Which is a very good thing.
Yeah.
But the political leaders, including the people running for president, or now person running for president,
they deny it.
And yeah, Donald Trump says that it is a hoax, mm-hmm. created by the Chinese, which is asinine. I mean, it's completely ridiculous.
Yeah, which is extra ridiculous. Like, it doesn't even have, and it's not even like Inhofe level ridiculous. It's like worse. I don't know about that.
Inhofe, I think, is one of the worst of all of the deniers.
Yeah, well, because he sat on the House Science Committee. Yes. Like, he actually has power to do something about it.
Exactly.
But do you think that the clusterfuck that has been the Republican nomination up to this point, and the divisiveness of Trump being the nominee, do you think that that will have an effect on more rifting within the Republican Party, that you actually are starting to see moderate Republicans and more thoughtful Republicans sort of coalescing together in a not my nominee stance, that may have some sort of effect on their ability to see reason with this issue?
I think the people on the extreme side are going to become more extreme.
Yeah.
And they're going to shut down completely to any sort of a conversation about the reality behind it. But I think there could be a positive in that the more moderate Republicans may see that that's extremism, and maybe I need to move away from that.
Yeah, like if Trump believes it, I need to maybe rethink my own stance.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because I disagree with him with so many other things.
Yes.
Trump's a weird one, though, because sometimes he's got it right on the nose. Like, there are a handful of things that he said where I'm like, don't say that, because that's reasonable.
I know. One of the most depressing moments is when you actually agree with Donald Trump.
Yeah, when I think he recently made statements about trans individuals and separate bathrooms, you know, in contrast to Cruz's statements. And I was like, no, don't be liberal about this.
Exactly. Don't be on Trump's side. It's the worst.
So bad. But that is also, I think, what it means to be a skeptic, right? It's to make a decision based on the evidence and not make a decision based on a sectarian view, a tribalist view. So yes, sometimes I am going to agree with Trump, which is a bummer, but I'm not going to, out of principle, change my viewpoints because of that, which is important. And not everybody does look at the world through that lens. I am happy to see that there's a trend towards understanding that human-caused climate change is real. Do you think that education is the answer? Do you think that it's because of a knowledge deficit? Or do you think that there's another way to change hearts and minds about this?
Education's a big part, but it has to get beyond throwing numbers or throwing charts and graphs at people. People have to be able to see not only okay, here's a projection of CO2, or here's what the parts per million are in the environment currently. It's here's some actual impacts of what are happening today as a result of climate change. And you can see everything from the drought in California. Climate change doesn't cause the drought, but it makes the drought worse, mm-hmm. and it makes it more persistent, and the impacts of the drought become worse. You look at the flooding in Houston.
Oh my God, very that was recently, so terrible.
Which was horrible.
Yeah.
And Texas, Republican state, I'm sure a lot of people are like, nope, it's just an act of God. It's mm-hmm. like, well, no, there is very strong science that doesn't say those floods are caused by climate change, but you can attribute some of the impact, how bad they were to climate change.
Yeah, it's the same with hurricanes, right? We were recently talking about on the SGU, like climate change is not going to cause, you can't link a hurricane specifically to climate change, but we can see trends that they are going to be more powerful, that they are going to be more destructive, just kind of across the board. There seem to be a lot of what the insurance company would call an act of God. There's mm-hmm. just going to be, God is just going to be more and more pissed lately.
He's going to be very active yeah. out there. And you can look at an example like Superstorm Sandy mm-hmm. is a good example. Would that have happened without climate change? Possibly. There was warm waters off of the coast, which strengthened the storm. Normally the jet stream would have pushed that storm back out to sea. But due to some changes in the way that the jet stream was functioning and the warmer waters off of the coast, it went straight into the coast. With the warmer ocean waters as well, that provides more power to these storms. And on top of that, you have some sea level rise, which yeah. some of it is more natural causes, some of it is due to climate change. And that sea level rise caused the storm surge to come even further in than it would have otherwise. And it's not like a one-to-one type basis either. If you go from a 3-foot to a 4-foot storm surge, the impacts become much greater. It's not, oh, it's 30% more, 25% more. It can be more like 50, 60% more because it reaches more land and yeah. more infrastructure that was thought to be safely away from the sea.
And so we saw this, obviously, a good example was in New Orleans when the levees broke and the levees just weren't up to snuff. Another good example, again, we were just talking about on the SGU, was the famous hurricane of 19 in Galveston. Is it 1901? 1918?
I don't remember that.
It was
one
of the worst hurricanes of like in the most destructive in the history of the United States. And you see this happening when the infrastructure either isn't in place or it's only in place up to a certain point, right? Yeah. That you're, well, historically, we're never going to have this issue beyond X, you know, feet inland. And the ocean is higher, right? The sea level has risen, and it's a double whammy. It's the water's warmer, which makes it expand more, and that we physically have land ice now melting into the oceans, which, you know, people always, I think there's a big complication between or confusion between sea ice and land yep. ice. And people argue, oh, but the pole, there's more ice now. And so how could that be climate change? So do you want to maybe take a minute to kind of help clarify the difference between the two?
Absolutely. Couple things there. First of all, in terms of the sea level rise. Mm-hmm. As you said, part of it is the thermal changes in ocean water. As water heats up, it expands. I won't be able to give you exact percentages.
Sure.
Nobody could, but it's about a third of sea level rise is currently caused by thermal expansion of the water.
Wow, that's a lot.
About a third of sea level rise comes to the land ice melting from Greenland.
Geez, that's also a whole lot.
And about a third comes from the Antarctic ice sheets melting.
Mm-hmm.
So those are your three main factors to sea level rise. There's a lot of other things that come into play and land-based glaciers, quite a few other things. But when you look at the dominant factors for it, those are your three. So coming back, what was the question?
Yeah, so you know, when we talk about the difference between land ice melting, which is bad because it used to be on land and now it's in the sea, yeah. which means it's contributing to sea level rises, people oftentimes will try to use their tricky sort of rhetoric to say, oh, but the sea ice in this region is more icy, like it's not melting, or it's actually freezing more. So obviously there's no climate change.
Yeah.
But there's a difference between a sea ice melt and a land ice melt with respect to how it affects sea level.
Absolutely. So looking at sea ice, it's kind of like having a drink and having ice inside of the drink. That ice melts. It doesn't raise the level of fluid in the cup.
Because there's already water in the cup. It's just in a different form of matter.
Exactly. But if you had like some ice sitting on top of the cup and like on top of a grate and the ice is melting into the cup, it'll fill up the cup and it'll overflow the cup. And that's what's happening. That land ice, as that melts, that adds to the volume of the oceans. Mm. And that causes the sea levels to rise. And an interesting thing about land ice and sea ice, it's very obvious. I mean, you can see it visually, but also they use satellites for seeing the thickness of the sea ice and the movement of the land ice and the movement of the land ice. Mm-hmm. We are losing massive amounts of land ice in both Greenland and the Antarctic. Now, sea ice, if you look in the Arctic, is melting dramatically. And that, again, is something that is visually apparent. And also it's apparent because now people are talking about going and drilling for oil up there.
Yeah.
Which previously was impossible to do. That's now becoming much more possible, which is very ironic, due to climate change. So coming down to the Antarctic, there have been some expansions of sea ice. So people say, aha, sea ice is expanding, therefore climate change isn't real. That's actually one of the denial talking points.
Yeah.
It's in their handbook. And it's a complicated thing. The entire Earth, when you say global warming, doesn't mean every single part of the Earth is warming. There are parts that are getting colder and parts that are getting warmer. Overall, it's getting warmer. There are some parts down in the Antarctic that are getting a little bit colder. But another interesting thing, and this isn't exact perfect science, but if you take ice and it melts, the temperature of that water is colder than the ocean temperature there.
Yeah.
You also now have fresh water versus salt water. If you take a cup of salt water and pour gently some fresh water on top of it, it'll float on top of it. It has lower density. So if you start picturing all of this ice from the land melting down into the Antarctic, into the ocean, it actually floats on the top. You get some mixing, of course, but you get floating of this fresh water.
Because salt water makes it denser, right? That's why you float in salt water, but you don't float in fresh water.
It's lower density, so it'll stay near the surface.
Yeah.
The other thing you have to look at is the melting point or the freezing point of water. So out there in the winter, well, I guess you didn't get in Texas. We don't get in California.
No,
but
yeah.
In
what
the
is winter
states, they have to salt the roads. They salt the roads to melt the ice. Fresh water will freeze easier than that salt water.
Yeah.
So if you have more fresh water and it's floating on the top surface and it freezes easier, what does that mean? You can have expansion of sea ice as a direct impact of climate change and as a direct impact of that land ice melting.
That's fascinating. And horribly depressing. You know, I'm wondering if these kinds of visual descriptions that we see, you know, the sad polar bear all alone with the ice just like calving like next to it into the ocean, or there was a Vice piece on Greenland which was not amazing, but it was beautifully shot and there were aspects of it that were really telling, and they were going with some researchers and they had placed these kind of spikes into the ice with markers. I think there were flags on top, and then they would go back year after year. And it was dramatic. Like, you would see where the flag was at the surface last year, and now it's, like, sticking 6 feet out of the ice. Like, that's dramatic. I'm wondering if those sort of visual representations do more for the public than looking at graphs and charts and hearing numbers and hearing about international meetings and committees. Or is it really what it does to people? Because I think the problem with looking at a glacier melting or looking at a sad, skinny polar bear, as much as it affects a certain percentage of the population, is it doesn't really speak to people. But when you see Bangladeshi, you know, locals losing their homes and getting ill, dying because of a direct result of climate change, it's more impactful. Problem is, here in America, we don't fucking feel it.
Yeah. And anything that's happening in any other part of the world, in the United States, first of all, it doesn't get any media attention.
None.
And even if somehow it does, people don't connect with it. So I think one of the keys is to start really tying in some of the events that are occurring in the United States. Mm-hmm. It's a probably a selfish thing that we only care about what's happening within our borders. But if that's what it takes, then that's what we need to do.
Yeah, so it'll have a greater impact. I mean, go to where the audience is.
So if you look at Sandy, or you look at the flooding in Houston, or you look at the drought in California, and you can start attributing climate change to part of that impact. And then you can start talking about, what does this really mean? Like, how does it impact not only the people who are there, but how does it impact you and your wallet, and your bottom line? It's like, you look at the drought in California. California makes, and again, not exact numbers here, but we produce about 25% of the food in this entire country in the Central Valley. When we have the drought and crop yields go down and you lose 10%, 20%, 30% of that food production, that makes food prices go up.
Yeah.
And it can be very significant. Like we saw in the Midwest when there was the mega drought, and that was not that long ago, what, 3-4 years back, the price of wheat doubled.
Yeah.
That has an impact on every single person's pocketbook. That's something real. That's where people can go, oh, if this got dramatically worse, if the drought in California turned into a mega drought and went 10 years, we could see food prices double. We could see that. And for somebody who's living in a mansion in Beverly Hills, not a big deal. But for the vast majority of people who are going paycheck to paycheck, you have all of a sudden your food prices double. That's a big problem.
Isn't that kind of the sick irony of climate change, is that the wealthy nations who are actually doing the most to cause the problem are the last to feel it? Or even if we do feel it, it just doesn't hurt us as badly. And we're really, in many ways, the only nation that, or one of few nations that can really do something about it, because it's our missteps that are contributing so much. One of the biggest talking points that I hear from climate denialists, it's so frustrating, is this idea of, well, China or India, or, you know, they'll kind of move the target somewhere else. Oh, well, yeah, even if it were true, if China's not willing to play ball, like, why should we pick up all the slack? Why should we take an economic hit to make these massive changes that are going to be so expensive if they're not going to? And I guess that's a less relevant argument now, because we're actually seeing major changes happening in China. But it was a really common talking point maybe like 3 years ago.
Absolutely. And there's a couple of points that you really look at there. First of all, is China has now surpassed the U.S. in terms of emissions, but they have about 4.2 times the population. So it's much more relevant to look at per capita emissions, not total emissions. And we are still leading the world by a long shot. Now, there's a couple of Middle Eastern countries that are a little bit worse, but looking at the world powers, the United States has one of the highest per capita emissions. So we're still leading, unfortunately, in that category. Looking at other things, China has a lot of people who are still living basically in poverty, and they're trying to build the middle class. And in doing so, previously, that, I wouldn't say required, but coal was the easiest path forward to do that. That's changing now. When we had the global recession, these stimulus packages, China took, again, no exact numbers, but China took about 50% of that and invested it in renewable energy and associated investments. The United States was less than 10%. China has become the world leader in producing renewable energy products, and the U.S. is now lagging behind. This is a huge economic opportunity, and we're not taking advantage. The first movers are going to have huge advantages here. They're going to be building the solar panels and the wind turbines. We're going to be buying them from China, which we already are.
Yeah.
They're able to outproduce almost every single one of the U.S. companies.
Do you think that, I mean, a lot of people will argue that it comes down to economics. When you start getting to the core of, you know, the standard sort of move the goalpost formula of the denier's argument style, which is, oh, climate change isn't really real. Okay, but look at this day. Okay. Well, maybe it's maybe there is a trend, but like, we're not causing it. Yeah, but if you compare this to today, okay, but even if we were causing it, why would we invest so much more? Why would we want to change our economic strategy? This is where it almost always seems to kind of whittle down to, I don't know, why are people so impassioned about wanting to stick to conservative economic standpoints? And I guess, B, like, I always struggle with this view of sort of like, it's a win-win situation for us if we invest more in renewables, if we start to move away from fossil fuels, and we try to have a more off-the-grid sustainable society. Like, I guess I just really don't understand, again, why somebody who is not on the board of an oil company is so desperately clinging to wanting to be able to use their good old oil.
Yeah, and that really comes down to that whole idea of tribalism.
Yeah.
The whole idea of, this is my party's stance. And that all really comes from the fossil fuel industry and their intentional misleading of the public as to whether climate change is real. One of the big stories that started last year, it's going to become an even bigger story as time goes on here, is the whole Exxon New story. Exxon, back in, I think it was the mid-1970s, had their scientists investigating the impacts of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. They were some of the first groundbreaking climate scientists out there. They determined that climate change was real. The greenhouse effect was real. It was being caused by fossil fuel emissions, and that something needed to be done because it was going to reach a crisis point. Exxon at that point could have gone out, unveiled all of their findings, and determined now is the time to start looking at future technologies, future energy, to be able to transition our world away from this. What did they do?
Bury it.
They buried it.
Yeah.
Not only did they bury it, they also internally strategized for climate change is going to reach this point. So we now need to reinforce our infrastructure as a company to be able to drill under these conditions.
It's like, and they buried it, and then they worked on a strategy that was based on mitigating climate change.
Absolutely.
So crazy.
So they took actions knowing climate change was going to happen. They buried it, and then they took it a step further. They actually started funding climate denial groups.
Yeah.
You know, the Heartland Institutes of
Koch
the world.
Koch brothers.
The Koch brothers, yeah, did it as well. And the API, the American Petroleum Institute, which has a lot of big U.S. companies, ConocoPhillips and Shell and quite a few others, they all went in on this together. And their intention there wasn't necessarily to disprove climate change, which is almost impossible to do, mm-hmm, when you really get down to it. It was just to create enough confusion, to muddy the waters, to say there's a lot of unknowns out there and the science isn't really settled. So before we take action, what we really need to do is more research.
And that really fucks the public because it puts scientists in a position where just communicating science becomes activism. When you politicize a scientific topic that is apolitical, that is simply, this is fact and this is fiction, this is what the data tell us and this is what the data don't tell us, but the climate around it, no pun intended, becomes so politicized, what you find is scientists starting to shy away from talking about it publicly, starting to shy away from having strong opinions about it publicly because they don't want to get caught up in a politics game. And then you don't have anybody arguing on Team Planet Earth. It becomes, except for the Greenpeace kind of fucking fluffy activists who you almost don't always want to be aligned with. It's a difficult position to be in.
Absolutely. And you look at scientists, and they've been attacked by these climate denial groups. If you look at the book Manufacturing Consent, it goes into a lot of very specific examples. But there's these people who knew that the science was solid. So instead of attacking the science, they attacked the scientists.
Mm-hmm.
And they tried to undermine their reputation and accuse them of doing things, of changing data or manipulating data or omitting data to fit what they wanted the message to be. And it was very effective. You also look at what the media does. You know, you look at the media from way back in the day with the Fairness Doctrine. The media is trying to show a balanced argument on this. So they have both sides. Well, the science, it's basically a consensus. You know, you hear a lot of numbers out there, 97% is the number that most people say, but basically there's a scientific consensus. Mm-hmm. The entire scientific community, not only in the United States, but worldwide, agrees that climate change is real, it's happening now, it's man-made, and we need to act. But the media feels this need, or they do it because it gets people to watch.
Yeah.
That if you create this argument, this balanced argument, well, we have one scientist and we have one guy who disagrees with the scientist. Let's have them yell at each other a little bit, and we're doing our job as journalists. They're not.
It's horrible. Yeah. One time I was on fucking The Young Turks, which is a show I used to go on quite a bit. I still go on sometimes. And that's a really overtly liberal, progressive news network online. But this was back when it was on Current TV. And I remember Cenk booked me on this episode. And he's like, I want you to come on. I want you to talk about climate change. I was like, okay, cool. So I like beefed up on it and got ready to go on. And then he's like, oh, yeah, by the way, so-and-so is coming. I don't even remember the fucktard's name. But it was like some horrible climate denial list, like a big time climate denial, who's doing all the media rounds. And he's like, oh, by the way, you're going to be on with him. And I'm like, Cenk, why the fuck are you doing this to me? Like, it's not good for your audience. It's not good for your reputation or my reputation. And again, it was all the bullshit, you know, talking points. And of course, it's one thing to know the data. It's another thing to be good at debating, which I don't think is my strong suit. And so I felt woefully unprepared to be able to go up to basically a very, I don't know, charismatic talking point machine. And this is what you see a lot of times. You see these mismatched fights on air between a scientist who knows everything that he possibly needs to know, he or she, and a denialist who's a way better talker. And then what is the viewing public supposed to think?
Absolutely. And they can just run over most scientists. And you'll find most scientists now avoid putting themselves in these positions. Mm-hmm. You have a handful of scientists who truly can handle that. But that's really not the case for the most part.
And they're targeted. Yeah. You know, they've been just attacked. Their personal lives have been attacked. They've been, you know, every single little thing put underneath the microscope. Just how difficult. I mean, you basically have to fall on your sword to be in that position. You have to say, this is my calling. I never wanted it to be my calling. I just wanted to do good science. But now I'm the ambassador for this, and, you know, come at me.
Yeah, and that's actually kind of one reason for what I'm trying to do and what I intend to continue doing is we have to have people who are willing to stand up to the denialists, who can be aggressive, who aren't the actual scientists, mm-hmm. but can communicate in a regular way. One of the things I've been trying to do on my site is kind of rewrite some of what the scientists have been putting out to the public in a way that people are going to understand. You know, if you're using way too many graphs and way too many numbers and way too many scientific terms, how many people are going to really sit down, read that, absorb that, and walk away with, I need to do something now? Very, very few people. But if you can take it and turn it into something that's more consumable, make it a little bit more interesting, a little bit more fun, that's really the approach that I think we need to make as a group. So we really need our own like firm that goes out and takes the science and translates it into something that we can hear, which is really what you do and what science communicators do. And we need that in climate science.
Mm-hmm. We need it more because I definitely will admit, I'll be the first to admit that climate science isn't my strong suit. It's something where if I'm called to do it for a TV show or for something that I can usually bone up and I can reach out to my to different experts and my different sources and you know, try to be ready for it. And if I'm in a position or have a platform where I'm there to communicate a specific aspect, I'm usually okay. But you throw me in the ring with a denialist and it becomes a different situation altogether. So for me, what I also would love, and I'm sure what a lot of people listening would love, is just like the denialists kind of have their playbook, to have the anti-denialist playbook. It's like, what are the common arguments that denialists make and what are some good responses to those in a clean, simple, not overly complicated way? You know, how at a dinner table can I say, yeah, that's a common talking point, but actually this is the case.
Yeah. And that's a really good point. There are very common arguments that are used mm-hmm. in climate denial.
It's kind of always the same shit over
it's
and over.
It's the same shit every single time, though it's getting a little bit more advanced as they progress. I mean, at the beginning, as you'd said earlier, it was climate change isn't even happening. Mm-hmm. The earth isn't even warming.
That's the Inhofe, right? It's the greatest hoax ever perpetrated. Yeah. Is that what he called it?
Exactly. And he has a book too. It's on Amazon. Check it out.
It's God.
Great. I've done a couple of tech pieces on that guy. Just a real piece
horrible.
Of work.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Piece of work.
Woohoo.
But if you look at that statement, you would think that that would be basically extinct at this point because the data is there, the science is there, the consensus is there. But Ted Cruz had a panel not too long ago, this is very recently, and used the same talking point. He came out and said, here, we have this data right here. Look at this graph. Look, the line is going down. The earth is cooling. Well, what the jackass did and what they continue to do is, okay, if you look at the temperature of the earth, mm-hmm. there's multiple methods of looking at it. Three of the biggest methods are looking at the atmospheric temperatures, which they generally do with satellites. You have the surface temperatures and you have ocean temperatures. And if you put all that together, look at it over time, extremely clear path of warming. But there's a lot of variability with each one of those data sets. One of the data sets that has a lot of variability is in the atmosphere. So there's the troposphere and the stratosphere. The troposphere is the lower part, which basically contains most of that carbon dioxide. So when we emit these greenhouse gases, they basically block the heat from exiting the troposphere and going into the stratosphere. But the troposphere is very sensitive to El Niños and La Niñas, which is, of course, the ocean warming and cooling and emitting warm air into the atmosphere and cool air into the atmosphere. So one of the largest El Niños of recent history was in 1998. Okay. 1998, we had a monster El Niño. We just are finishing up with one now as well. 1998 was huge. So what we ended up having from the satellite data was a big spike in the temperature in the troposphere. Mm-hmm. Huge spike that was way outside of the graph. Then it kind of came back down a little bit to a much more normal but higher than average level. Now, what did they do? They started their graph at 1998. And then they ran it for about 5 years and they looked at the line and they said, look, it went down. The earth is cooling. We have disproven climate change and global warming. And Ted Cruz used that just months ago. This is shit they were using years ago, which is ridiculous. And any scientist is going to laugh them off the stage. But we have somebody, a previous presidential candidate, saying this stuff in front of the country. This is real shit that's happening right now. And it's completely asinine. No scientist would ever look at a tiny little piece of data. It's like looking at the stock market and saying, well, you know, the stock market over 100 years has gone up. And then somebody looks at one day or 1 hour and says, nope, it goes down.
Yeah.
It's completely ridiculous. And it's cherry-picking data.
Not only is it cherry-picking data, it's cherry-picking data at the best possible moment that they could.
Exactly.
It's like cherry-picking a part of basically just homeostasis. Like, yeah, that's after a massive spike. If you want, and I understand, like, okay, maybe we want to go through the data and take out any of the outliers so that we can look for real trends instead of, but that's not even what they did. They used the outlier as their starting point.
Exactly.
Which is insane. And I think this is something that you see over and over and over again, where one of the biggest talking points is going through the data and either cherry picking specific times or manipulating it in a certain way that, you know, you can kind of always, through the use of very smart statistics, tell the story that you want to tell. And that's why it's so important that scientists are well-trained in statistics. And that's why it's so important that you remember the misses, not just the hits. You know, it's a very kind of skeptic 101 standpoint. You've got to look at all the data in order to really understand what's going on. But it's hard. It's hard for the public to see a beautiful visual representation with somebody who's in a position of power and authority making a very strident kind of statement. It's hard to say, oh, that guy's a bullshitter. It's much easier to be like, well, that sounds legit. You know,
I think it sounds better than a lot of the science.
Of course, because the science is fucking complicated.
Exactly.
It's like, well, it sort of fits the model, but here you'll see a fluctuation in there. And yes, it was cooling for this amount of time, but then generally overall, and you're like, that kind of sounds like bullshit.
Yeah.
That guy sounds like he knows what he's talking about.
Exactly. And science deals in uncertainty, mm-hmm. and we deal with confidence levels, and we deal with all of these things.
Error bars.
Yeah, exactly. And everything is attackable. Yeah. And that's the way science should be, and that's the way it is, but it opens the door for somebody to come in and just manipulate that little piece where it's like, can you say with 100% certainty that the recent warming is caused by climate change and man-made emissions? A good scientist is going to say, I can't say with 100% certainty,
yeah.
but I can say with a very high level of confidence. And they're like, aha.
Yeah. So, what you're saying is there's a chance.
There's a chance.
Yeah. No, it's so true. It's like, you know, it's a common argument that you'll hear about the left versus the right is that the left often like should have a better PR firm. Like the right is so good at pithy, you know, statements and, you know, death panels during Obamacare and like always say, and Obamacare, why do we fucking call it that? Why didn't we call it Medicare for All? Like you see this problem all the time. And I think it's even worse in the scientific community. I mean, I'll be the first one to say it as not only just a science communicator, but as somebody who's made a living interviewing scientists, both for TV and for podcasts and things. The vast majority of scientists fucking suck at communicating their science. They're working on it. It's becoming better. But oftentimes, unfortunately, the more established somebody is, the more prize winning they are, the more people trust them. It usually means they're older. It usually means that they spend way more time in the lab than they do actually talking to the media. And sometimes, more often than not, I might even venture to say, that translates to them being worse at communicating their science.
Yeah, absolutely. And you actually see, which I think is one of the hardest parts, is somebody like James Hansen, who comes out and makes very bold statements about what may happen.
Mm-hmm.
He gets attacked by the scientific community as well, because he's coming out with data that maybe is towards that higher bar.
And
maybe
it's speculative in their mind.
There's
yeah.
some speculation there. And the scientists go, whoa, 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 this isn't what we do. Mm-hmm. We need to go through the peer review process. We need to have everybody take a look at this before you make your statement. Then you know what? We need to kind of be a little bit more conservative with what we're saying. But the end result of that is information that comes out of like the IPCC, which is very conservative projections of what may happen, couched in this very not so scary language. You know,
it's
you can
really
read their reports and you walk away going, yeah, things are going to be all right.
Yeah.
You read what James Hansen says and you go, holy shit. Like, we're going to have coastal cities destroyed. We're going to have massive problems for tens of millions of people. We're going to have human migration, which is going to cause massive chaos, just like what we saw. And this isn't sea level rise, but this is drought in Syria. The drought in Syria led to a big part of the problems we're seeing right now, because we had mass migrations of people from an area that used to produce food that turned into a freaking desert.
Yeah.
And all of those people moved into the city. And then that helped to topple everything. That turned into a migration problem into different countries. It's turned into a massive, massive issue. We're going to see the same thing play out over and over again, from sea levels rising and taking out coastal areas, from droughts, from wildfires. All these different things are going to cause people to have to move. And when people have to move in large numbers, it leads to war, it leads to conflict, leads to terrorism, it leads to all of these massive things that are threats to our national security, which is why the DOD and the Pentagon have climate change as risk multipliers. They look at areas of the country that are risky towards our national security, and they say climate change will multiply that risk in these areas. This isn't a liberal group of people. This isn't the left wing. This is the fucking DOD and the Pentagon saying this shit's real, and it's going to cause massive problems, and it's going to be a big threat to our country's national security. And still, the Republican Party won't even admit that it's real.
And you would think if any talking points are going to be effective, that we should be using those. We should be, if this has already become a politicized issue, because we've allowed it to become a politicized issue on the right, talking about best economic practices and where should we be putting our funding, why don't we start having the conversation as it being a geopolitical issue? As this is going to have, or is already having, a massive effect on national security, on infectious disease, on global population imbalance, on financial security across the globe. I mean, all of these things are sort of like the horsemen of the apocalypse. You know what I mean? Like, these are the things that at a national level, the government, these are the things they're having the conversations about behind closed doors.
Yeah.
Yet, as a population, we all often talk about it as like, oh, it's going to get warmer. Like, that's our biggest concern. Like, oh, what are we going to do when it's so fucking hot outside? It's like, that's not the issue.
Yep.
The issue is, what are we going to do when people are displaced? What are we going to do when people don't have access to basic needs, you know, to have their basic needs fulfilled, which happens, yeah, fundamentally when people, like you said, are forced to experience these mass migrations. We're not good at it. We used to be good at it when there weren't that many people and there weren't that many boundaries. Now that we are operating in a very factioned, you know, on a factioned level across the globe, just look at the problem, the clusterfuck around this mass Syrian migration. Look at how poorly it's been handled by basically every nation to whom these refugees look for help.
And that's one specific area, one specific problem. And you look at it on a global scale, it turns into a huge national security issue. It turns into a lack of resource issue, resource scarcity. It's a huge problem. Sometimes the global warming, which doesn't sound that scary, mm-hmm. you know, people are like, oh, 2 degrees Celsius, that's not so bad,
it's
right?
It's a lot. And also climate change sounds less scary than global warming.
Yeah,
it does. It's an even softer euphemism.
It's like, okay, well, the climate's going to change a little bit. All right, yeah. Well, it changes all the time. It's going to be fine.
Yeah.
So I actually did a piece on my blog and I titled it Climate Change is Not Real. And I went in, had a little fun with it, of course, and basically said that climate change was this global conspiracy that was thought up by scientists to, you know, control this, and China was involved, and had fun with it. But then said, okay, climate change isn't real. Ignore climate change. Pretend it doesn't even exist. Now let's look at the ramifications of fossil fuel use, and looked into air pollution and water pollution, looked into military costs in terms of protecting fossil fuel resources. Looked into ocean acidification, which is a huge, massive problem. That's actually like the dark part of climate change that doesn't get a lot of airwaves,
yeah,
but
and
it needs it.
When we do talk about it, it's like we talk about, we use terms like ocean acidification, which sound confusing, and we don't talk about hypoxia, we don't talk about dead zones, we don't talk about... you know, we might say, oh, and coral bleaching, like to somebody who understands what that means, it's dire. But to the general public, like, if we lose all of our reefs, do you fucking know what that means for the ecosystem? We're talking about dead oceans. Like, that should be the new label.
Absolutely. And ocean acidification, it's big term, sounds kind of scary, very sciencey, mm-hmm. but it's really basic. A lot of the
it's basic. Sorry,
you like that was good.
It's the opposite.
Nice. It's the opposite of basic. That's good. I like that. So I'll retract that statement. If you look at ocean acidification, we emit carbon dioxide and quite a few other greenhouse gases. It's not just carbon dioxide, but that's the primary one. Our oceans are carbon sink. It means that they absorb a lot of carbon. Mm. Our forests, the Amazon, the boreal forests, all of these different areas, they actually suck in carbon. If they didn't, we would be so screwed we wouldn't even know what to do at this point. But fortunately, they absorb a lot of that carbon. Well, when the ocean absorbs that carbon, it creates carbonic acid. And carbonic acid in the oceans means that they're a lot of sea life will have difficulties. Well, first of all, it lowers the pH. It makes it more acidic. And we're at about 30% more acidic than we were at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah.
But it also interferes with the ability of sea life to form calcium carbonate, mm-hmm. which is what is used to create shells. Our favorite foods, our lobsters, our oysters, our mussels, that's a calcium carbonate shell. And another huge one is coral.
Yeah.
Coral reefs where a huge percentage of our fish either are born or live or are in at some part in their life cycle. If you have the inability for these shells to form or to form completely, and you see massive die-offs of coral reefs, of lobster and mussels and all these things, that could be a massive hit to the human food supply.
And not just the human food supply. Like, that is such a huge ecological niche that... what you see is the things that they eat overpopulating, and you see these big blooms that are really dangerous. You see the things that eat them starting to die off because they can't find their own food source. So yeah, we can't eat the shellfish, but also we can't eat the bigger things that eat the shellfish. And eventually you just see this cascade of death. Like, yep. We are in the sixth extinction. Like, we are seeing a massive, global extinction right now. And for whatever reason, we don't seem to fucking notice.
Yeah, nobody notices, especially in the United States, because there's always food on the table. We always have food coming in. But there's areas where locals used to subsist on the fish in local lakes or local oceans, and the fish are gone.
Yeah, they're gone.
They're not there anymore.
Like, you guys, like, the tuna's not going to be on the shelf soon.
Yeah.
Like, the fact that we eat tuna in such a crazy quantity that it has just become this, like, we treat it like it's a never-ending supply. But these are deep-sea, huge fish that are, we're you know, fishing it to extinction. And so on top of the overfishing, we also have an ocean that can no longer sustain life as it did. And you see these weird species. Because, right, we think about pH. Not only can the shellfish not make their shells, not only can is the coral bleaching out and it can no longer sustain life, which is, you know, fucking coral reefs are the rainforests of the, it's where all the biodiversity is. Think about pH, even if you don't understand, you know, what it is with the proton concentrations and the logarithmic scale. You've heard of pH. Your blood has a certain type of pH. It's 7.35. That's what I was just Googling. I knew it was somewhere around 7. I couldn't remember where. 7.35. And we have buffers in place, carbon being one of them. Actually, interesting. Breathing helps us keep our blood pH where it needs to be. That if it just goes like 2 points high, and not like 8, like you'll die, but like 7.38, you know, 7.46, like death. Like death, it's this very narrow range that we have to keep our pH in order for everything within our body to work, all the proteins to do what they're supposed to do, all our enzymes to do what they're supposed to do. And think about, we're seeing a massive shift in the ocean. So not just can these organisms not make their shells, not just does the coral not subsist, like, you see massive die-offs of organisms that have not adapted to live in an ocean that is as acidic as it is becoming. Yep. It's happening too fast for evolution to be able to keep up with it. Hey guys, it's time to take a quick break to thank our sponsor of this week's episode, Atomic Insights. Well, we've been talking about climate change on the show. Why not bone up even more on clean energy, electric grids, energy politics, economics, and emerging technology in the energy sector? Atomic Insights has been on the web since 1995. Its editor and publisher, Rod Adams, is a retired submarine officer with more than 30 years of experience and training, and his special focus on nuclear energy busts through a lot of the pseudoscience and the myths out there that exist on the subject, offering a clear and scientifically minded perspective on nuclear technology. For example, did you know that atomic fission uses compact, abundant fuel? Only a 9-gram fuel pellet produces as much heat energy as 1,000 kilograms of coal. 9 grams of atomic fuel versus 1,000 kilograms of coal. And guys, it does so more safely and more reliably. To arm yourself with more of this kind of information about atomic energy, visit atomicinsights.com. There, you're going to find over 2,000 articles and 250-plus podcast episodes on a variety of topics, all easily searchable and accessible with no ads and no paywalls ever. So what are you waiting for? Visit atomicinsights.com today. That's atomicinsights.com. All right, now let's get back to the show.
When we're talking about a lot of the changes that happen, and they go, oh, the climate always changes.
Yeah, what about the ice age?
It always changes.
Yeah.
These are gradual things that happen over thousands, tens of thousands a year. When you look at those time frames, animals can adapt.
Mm-hmm. And the ones that don't die, but other ones do, and they fill in the ecological niches.
Yep. They migrate, they adapt, they do what they need to do to live. But we're talking about things on a very short time frame that are happening very rapidly. And that's the risk. Nothing has the ability to evolve because you don't have enough generations mm-hmm. of that life form going through these changes to be able to evolve with the environment.
Yeah, so all we see are very specific species that already have mutations which allow them to subsist, and we're going to see biodiversity plummet.
Yep.
Like, there will always be organisms that can survive these kinds of crazy... I mean, we have fucking organisms that live on sulfur vents in the deep sea. Like, there will always be some things that can survive these huge shifts. The problem is the beautiful diversity of flora and fauna – that make Earth what it is, that is going into the shitter. Like, we're already seeing it happen. When people can't see the effects of climate change, it literally is right in front of us. It's just we hole ourselves up in our houses with brick walls, and we don't ever look at nature. And one thing you'll probably notice if you're a bird watcher, if you're somebody who likes to sit in your backyard and experience even the urban wildlife around you, is that you're just seeing less of the things that used to be there, less diversity. Or you might see way more of just one species, but a whole lot less of all the other species that we're filling in.
Yeah,
those
and you
niches.
See that in the oceans, like jellyfish. They love the warmer water.
Yeah, we're all going to be eating jellyfish.
Yeah. We better get a taste for jellyfish because they are expanding rapidly. But as they do that, they start overtaking areas. They start overfeeding on particular species, and they can wipe out species. So this gradual warming, oh, more jellyfish, not a big deal, right? No, it's a huge deal. They can actually destroy other species by becoming so successful in that environment. And just recently, there was a meta-analysis of a bunch of different investigations looking into loss of species. And this meta-analysis looked and said, based on current climate change models, we'll lose one out of every six species by the end of this century. One out of every six. And they didn't even look at the cascade effect or the domino effect. They just looked at the single level effect of it. So if one species goes away and that's the food supply for another species, that may go as well. You can see these massive cascade effects because we're dealing with these food webs. And they're very intricate. And they go well beyond one or two levels. It's not a food chain. It's a food web.
Yeah.
And you disrupt that web, you can wipe out the entire group.
And it takes time for that web to find its balance, this kind of this homeostatic balance. Like it takes, you know, hundreds of thousands, even millions of years for different organisms to find their place and to, and it ebbs and it flows and it adjusts, but that's all a function of time. And when you change something so incredibly drastically in such a short time frame, it sets off, it's like a nucleation site for this cascade of horribleness. And we do see, I feel like I covered, a study recently on SGU about the loss of marine biodiversity, and it was some sort of disturbing number. Like, we see the loss of biodiversity around us all the time, but it's especially evident in the sea. And like you were saying, one out of six by the end of the century. I'm trying to look up what a recent stat was about this, but I remember it being like disgusting. Hang on just a second. Okay, yeah, here it is. In the past 40 years, so just four decades, we have lost 49% of marine species. That's fucking crazy. Yeah, this Living Blue Planet report by the World Wildlife Fund in collaboration with the Zoological Society of London looked at extraordinary losses between 1970 and 2012, and they found that we lost 49% of marine species, and some fish species declined by almost 75%.
So then you add in acidification, loss of oxygen in the oceans, you add in pollution, overfishing, destruction of coral reefs. This is a massive part of our food chain. And if this collapses, we could see huge, huge problems for our species. And nobody talks about this.
Yeah.
It's scientific journals maybe, but
do you think it's because it's like it's just fucking depressing? Like, do you think anybody has already turned us off because they're like, this is too depressing for my morning commute?
I would be amazed if anybody has gotten this far.
It really is. It's hard because I don't know why. I feel compelled to watch depressing documentaries all the time, and I feel compelled to talk about things that are like the hard truths. And I know that there's a certain type of person out there, probably a big percentage of my listeners, who have that sort of that inclination. But we can't just plug our ears, because the truth of the matter is this is fucking fixable. Like, that's what bugs me. It's one thing to sit here and say it's gloom and doom we're never coming back from this. We're never coming back from it if we don't fucking do something about it.
And if we don't do something about it
now. But now. The same ingenuity that put us in a place where we're basically raping the planet of its resources and putting a lot of toxins into the planet, both in terms of greenhouse gases, but also just other pollutants, the same ingenuity that led to that we possess to be able to solve a lot of these problems.
Absolutely. And that's one of the talking points that, getting back to the climate deniers, mm-hmm. is that this one's very sophisticated. And they go, you know what? Human ingenuity will figure out this problem in the future. We don't have to worry about it now because technology will save us. We'll find ways to pull the carbon out of the atmosphere. We'll figure out these new ways to create energy with no emissions. It's like, no, not later, not in the future, now. We have the technology now.
Mm-hmm.
We have things that are very simple, like solar panels and wind turbines, geothermal, tidal, wave. We have all of these technologies that can create energy. And here's the thing, they've become as inexpensive or sometimes less expensive than fossil fuels. Like, solar panels have come down by 50% in the last 6 years. We have hit grid parity where renewable energy is at the same price or less expensive than coal or natural gas in many parts of the world and of the country.
Mm.
It's not there everywhere quite yet, but the costs keep coming down every single year.
And the more that we up demand, yep. the more we're going to see it. And that is a consumer choice.
Absolutely.
And like, that's not to say that we aren't sometimes faced with false choices. You know, I'll be the first to say that I sometimes will make decisions out of ease, or I'll make decisions because I don't have another decision. Simple things. Like, I always talk about how I hate drinking out of plastic. I like drinking out of, like, actually reusable plastic better than metal. I'm weird like that. I think water tastes weird out of metal. But I hate drinking out of a plastic bottle because I feel fucking horrible about it. I feel super guilty. The Coke that I'm drinking right now is a Mexican Coke out of a glass bottle.
It's out of glass.
It's out of glass.
Which will be recycled.
It's 100% recyclable.
Absolutely.
And your can is 100% recyclable as well. Plastic can maybe go through the cycle twice and then you're fucked. And then it goes to a landfill and never biodegrades. But that said, if I'm on a road trip and I stop at a convenience store and they only have water in plastic bottles, as a consumer, I might, you know, I'm not forced to do it, but I don't think it's easy enough for the consumer. I think that we need to see both more onus on the consumer to make better decisions, but also more onus on government to legislate a situation where the consumer has no other choice.
Yeah, and that's actually a very interesting point. And we've seen that recently mm-hmm. in the national parks.
Yeah.
So a lot of the national parks have been trying to get rid of bottled water. And the companies who bottle water and sell this stuff at 1,000 times the price of tap water, what do you think they're doing? They're lobbying against it.
The fuck out of it. Yeah.
And it's working.
Of course.
You know, these bans, they're going after it with their legal teams, because bottling tap water, basically taking water for free, like Nestle's doing in a lot of different parts of the country, including California. Mm-hmm. They take water for free, they put it in a plastic bottle, they mark it up 1,000 times, and they destroy the environment in the process.
Ugh.
And the national parks who want to install water filling stations across the parks and ban mm-hmm. bottled waters are now having these lobbying groups come after them.
That's so crazy.
And these legal teams coming after them saying, this isn't constitutional, you can't do this. It's disgusting.
Oh my gosh. And we have seen changes in California, which I really appreciate. Like, Los Angeles, for example, has a plastic bag ban. And it's not the same as the plastic bag ban, or not ban, but tax that you'll see in other parts of the country where they'll say, did you bring your own bag? No. Okay, then you can buy a plastic bag for 10 cents. Here it's both. It's, did you bring your own bag? No. Then you can buy a paper bag for 10 cents. So I really like that that has happened. And I've physically noticed a difference. Have you? Like, when you're walking
Absolutely.
By the LA River, when you're going on a hike, you don't see plastic everywhere anymore.
The side of the freeways used to just be like covered with yeah. plastic bags. And it's made a huge difference.
It really has. And something that small, just taking the time and I think that the will is there of the constituency. I think that the problem is when there is a solution in place to a problem that has been in place for so long that is easy and that is comfortable and convenient, you have to, in order to affect change, you have to replace it with something else that is just as easy, just as comfortable, just as convenient, and oftentimes just as cost-effective. And that's where we've really struggled, I think, with this environmental movement. The branding's been way off. It's been the crunchy granola hippies, the tree huggers, the anti-GMO activists. These are not my fucking people, right? But I'm still an environmentalist in the purest sense of the term. It's hard for me to identify with the yoga environmentalists.
Yeah. And there's definitely something to be said for that. It's like, personally, on my side, I'm pro-business.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pro-business. I'm pro-environment. I won't talk about my political stance, but yeah. You can probably guess from where I'm at. And I think that all works.
Yeah.
And if we can bring in people and say, it's okay if you're into capitalism. It's okay if you're in a business. That's fine.
Good thing. You can drive this.
Yeah, you can help us drive our country and our cities and our local communities into this new future where we are much more responsible with our resources, where we're paying attention to the pollution. We're paying attention to the environment. We can do this, and we can do this cost effectively. And it's not just local communities and cities and nations. It's global. There was a recent study that I was looking at just this morning, actually, and it looked at a bunch of countries that had reduced their carbon emissions.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not talking about small countries in the middle of nowhere. We're talking about major European countries. We're talking about the United States. There were 21 of the biggest countries on the planet that reduced their carbon emissions from 2000 and increased their GDP.
Mm.
So moving to this new renewable future, moving away from fossil fuels, isn't an economic death sentence. If anything, it's an opportunity. It's an opportunity for jobs. It's an opportunity for growth, for progress, for business. This is a good thing.
And it's in the definition. I mean, moving away from a finite resource to a renewable resource means that there will always be work around it. You know, it's like basic math and basic logic. And it's so crazy when you hear people arguing that we have to stick with fossil fuels as long as we can because it's better for the economy. How? How the fuck is it better for the economy?
It's not.
It makes us a slave to Saudi Arabia. It makes us actually make horrible geopolitical decisions, like making allies with a country with a horrible human rights record. Like, our allegiances are all over the fucking place. We've seen so much confusion and entanglement with conflict, with war, with indebtedness. And on top of that, we're still going to run out. We're going to fucking run out. Why are we doubling down when we see the resource actually dwindling?
Yeah. And that's a key point with fossil fuels. It is a finite resource. There's not a single person on the planet who could say that fossil fuels are an infinite resource. They aren't.
Mm-hmm.
They are ancient, fossilized, carbonized life forms that have been crunched down into the planet that we're pulling up. It's going to go away at some point. And it's what, like, we're starting to see is soon. It's starting to get much more expensive. It's like, oh, wow, we found this great resource in natural gas in the United States. Frack away, you know, frack the planet.
Fuck. And I mean, and it's so crazy because you'll see these little blips where it'll get cheaper, like the price of a barrel will get cheaper, either through subsidies or through like a new allegiance that we've made and opening up the floodgates. And then people like get really excited. And it's like, no, this is not a good thing. Like, it's not good when gas gets cheap. It's bad.
It's bad.
Gas should be expensive.
And when we look at natural gas, and I think this is an important thing to discuss when we're talking about climate change, there's been a lot of people, including President Obama, Hillary Clinton, who really pushed for fracking and for moving to natural gas. And I'm putting air quotes on this, but that it's a bridge fuel. It's not a bridge fuel.
It's the same fucking thing.
In a perfect environment, mm-hmm. in a perfect world where you can frack, where you can extract the gas, where you can transport the gas, and then use the gas without any leakage, it is a better solution than using gasoline. It's about 50% less carbon emissions. But here's the problem. It's not a perfect situation. We have methane leaking all across this country.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not only from the actual fracking process. It's not only from the transport from the locations where they're fracking to the storage locations. It's not only the storage locations. It's the pipes running through our cities with methane flowing into our air that we're breathing in.
And methane is contributing to climate change.
Massively to climate change. Methane is a by far stronger greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. So everybody's like, wow, we've done this great thing. We moved from coal. We shut down these coal plants. Now they're burning natural gas. 50% less carbon dioxide. Yeah, and now we've just quadrupled our methane in the environment. We are now hitting record levels of methane in our environment in human history.
Jesus. And that's not to mention all of the, again, direct consequences to health and human safety in the form of the fact that Oklahoma has more earthquakes than California now.
Yeah, you look at earthquakes, you look at the property damage caused by fracking, you look at water pollution, you look at air pollution. This is not a bridge fuel.
It's dirty.
It's a dirty fuel.
Yeah.
Every single fossil fuel is a dirty fuel. There's just no way around it. You know, you saw even getting into politics, apologize, but Hillary Clinton's in coal country trying to get votes in Indiana. And she's saying, yeah, I support carbon sequestration. You know, yeah, we can capture the carbon. We've been working towards carbon capture in these coal plants for decades, and we haven't gotten anywhere. It's not cost effective. That's not the solution. The solution is to shut that shit down.
And people always talk about, oh, but we'll lose jobs. It's like, you know what? To be a progressive country, things change. And we might lose those jobs, but we will have other jobs. And you cannot continue with industries that are failing us. You cannot continue with industries that are vestigial just to maintain the workforce. It's a backward approach to trying to keep the economy healthy.
And if you look at today, right now, there are three times as many solar jobs than there are coal jobs in this country.
And there's no reason you couldn't move right into one of those positions.
Exactly. And why not have our government create training programs and fund training programs to take the people who had these coal jobs? I'm not going to say, you know, oh, screw the coal, the people have these coal jobs. That's wrong. Let's get these people into good paying jobs that are safer, that pay better, that are more secure. Let's train these people to go install solar panels or maintain them or work on the electricity grid. There are many things that we're going to need when we move our country from burning coal and natural gas to using renewables. And these jobs are well-paying jobs. These are good jobs, and there are potentially millions of them out there if we are bold and make the move to these renewable energies.
I always wondered why it was that we didn't enact some sort of subsidy program, like I have with my electric car, right? I bought my electric car. I immediately got $5,000 off the price, and I didn't even buy. I'm leasing. I got $5,000 off the sticker price because of the federal rebate. The state of California sent me a check for $2,500 because of the state rebate. Why don't we, and we do have incentive programs for solar, but I've always wondered, think about like when we had the stimulus bill and everybody just got a check. Here's a fucking check. This is like the worst way to like stimulate the, here's a check, go spend it. But everybody's in debt. So they're like, I'm just going to pay my bills with this. And then it didn't help at all.
Not effective.
Not effective. What if I said, I want to put solar panels on my roof, but I can't afford to right now because it's expensive. Why doesn't the government help me put solar panels on my roof? And then I can pay for it little by little. And we have this massive relief off of the grid, which they need anyway. It's like we incentivize it after the fact instead of helping people get into it. Because I understand it's expensive up front. It's still not as cheap as just like using electricity, right? Just like saying, okay, because that you just pay for it as you get it. There's no upfront cost to like hooking up your electric. But, and it's expensive to put solar panels on your, I still haven't done it at my house because I'm like, oh, we just did a renovation. I don't know if we can afford it. If it was easier for me to do it up front and then help pay for it, maybe even you pay for it in what you would have always been paying. You take an average of what you would have been paying the electric company, and now that electric bill goes to pay back for the things. It doesn't affect you at all.
The good news is that exists from corporations, SolarCity.
Yeah.
Solar City basically does that type of thing. They go in and they install the solar panels. You don't have that upfront cost.
Mm-hmm.
And basically you are buying the electricity from them.
Gotcha.
Right now.
And that's subsidized.
That's subsidized by the government through.
You're giving them your electric for free. And then eventually it pays
exactly.
for the panels.
And right now, which was just extended, which is a good thing. There were some bad things in the bill that passed that got them extended, but so be it. There's some balance in politics and in government. There's what's called a feed-in tariff.
Okay.
So if you have your solar panels on your house, you're not going to be using all of the power that comes out of them. There's going to be times of the day where you're not using it.
Especially in LA.
In LA. So you can actually feed that power back into the grid and you get paid for that power.
Yeah.
Now, the utility companies hate this.
Oh, yeah.
They hate it. So basically, they come at it and say, well, you're now using the grid, so we're going to charge you to use the grid for maintenance and all these things, even though most of the costs of grids are on the original install of the grid and there's very little maintenance
and
that occurs.
And they're already paid for.
But yeah, and it's already paid for. Yeah. So they're basically saying, we lost our profits because we're not selling electricity to this person, so I'm going to make my profits back by not paying them this fee and tariff, or by charging them a particular amount.
A use
fee, exactly. So you have states like Nevada who basically the utility companies undermined the entire program, and SolarCity said, fine, fuck you, we're out. And they left the state.
Oh, wow.
They left the state entirely, even though it's one of the best states possible based on days of sunshine and all of that. It's a great state for solar power, but they're out.
Well,
and most of the installers left too.
And that's bold, and I think it's important what they did. Unfortunately, it leaves a lot of individual residents hanging.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a bummer. It's a tough decision you have
to make. So like you were saying, if there was a government-subsidized program, that was across all 50 states, now suddenly these states can't decide on their own with the influence from these utility companies to undermine those programs.
Yeah, and this is not me being a super libby socialist. Like, these programs exist for other things. Your fucking corn is subsidized. Yeah. A lot of the things that you have available to you, your fire department is subsidized. You know, these things are already helped, whether it's by your local or your federal government, but oftentimes local governments are fed by state governments or fed by the federal government. Depending on the program that we're talking about. This is not a new idea. It's just a way to implement a new idea and get it into practice faster. You know, this idea of like, let the market decide. Yeah, sure. In pure capitalism, which we don't have a purely capitalistic system, it's a hybrid. And the truth of the matter is sometimes you need a nudge at the beginning. And I think that people need a little bit of help. When something is new, it's expensive and it's complicated. There's only a handful of early adopters. Look at electric cars. You know what I mean? Like, A, everybody wants a Tesla. Nobody can fucking afford one because other electric cars have limitations. I know mine does. I can't go to half my shoots because my range isn't good enough. Not half. I can't go to 5% of my shoots. And then B, it's hard to catch on to something that's new when nobody in your community is doing it. It's easier in California. We're ahead of the curve here. But if I lived in Texas, I couldn't fucking drive my car. I wouldn't be able to drive to work. You know, I have an 80-mile range. I probably would drive 40 miles to work every day.
Yeah. And adoption rates in areas is a big part of it. And you'll see what your neighbors are doing and what their neighbors are doing across the board. And you see that with solar as well. You'll see some states where the adoption rates just through the roof, like a state like Hawaii, where it became such a problem, the utility companies now attacking the industry hardcore.
Oh, because they're probably like struggling to, they're like, the utility company's going to go bankrupt.
Yeah.
Which is awesome.
Yeah. Which, yeah, we love this.
Yeah.
This is the best thing ever. I mean, you want freedom?
Yeah.
That's an American, you know,
it's what we
are.
Well, that's the funny thing. Probably the most fucking, you know, right-wing, conservative, I have a bunker under my house, I have an arsenal in my home. They're off the grid. They have their own fucking generators, and they have all this
Absolutely.
Shit. Like, that's a goal. And not only can you do this with solar panels, you can do it with whole home batteries, which is a new big movement.
Yeah, especially with Tesla coming out with the Powerwall. Mm-hmm. You know, this is still expensive, not inexpensive, but it is affordable when you actually look at the long-term costs of
and
the product.
And that's the problem. When things cost a lot up front, I
it
mean,
becomes
it's why layaway was invented. It's why we live on credit. We are a culture of credit. And if we could figure out a way to help spread the cost out, and especially to ease the burden and just replace something you're already paying for, you know? That's why I love the idea of the electric swap for the solar. You're already paying an electric bill every month. Pay what you've always paid and it won't affect you at all.
And just the idea of being able to generate your own power.
That's
huge. You know, just completely cutting yourself off the grid. And you avoid so many problems of being tied to the grid. I mean, blackouts are becoming more and more common all the time, and there's different reasons for them. Some of it's really bad infrastructure, and some of it is not enough power being generated.
And some of it's, I mean, we have brownouts, they're intentional.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Oh,
that's
yeah.
kind of shit.
No, I came home just 2 days ago from work and tried to open up my car garage. It wasn't opening. It's like, what the fuck's going on here? Well, power's out. So I had to go park somewhere else and walk into the home, and I was out for 5 hours. You know, oh, it's like, what happened? It's like, yeah.
And it's hot. Yeah. Not fun.
Wasn't a fun day. And no. I couldn't microwave my dinner. I was really pissed off.
I had to go old school.
Exactly.
I wouldn't be able to use any of my appliances.
Well, you're in this new fancy house.
I know. So, I have an induction cooktop. And
Your Japanese toilet couldn't open its lid on its own. What would you do?
I'd have to go out back with the dog.
It wouldn't be heated. It'd be a nightmare.
It would. I would be lost. I'd be so confused. No, it's true. I mean, I think that the direction this conversation is headed is a hopeful one for me, and it's one that I'm excited about because there are options, there are answers, and sometimes it requires going like more high tech. Sometimes it just requires making decisions in your life that are a little more low tech, you know? It's like, where are the places in my home that I'm being wasteful? What are, you know, the stupid simple things like turning off lights when you're not in the room? They're so important. And I think when we were kids and we learned about these environmental clues, people, probably our generation and younger, sort of the millennial, Gen X, cusp and younger, we grew up with these conversations being had on Sesame Street and in the classroom. We knew this was a problem when we were children. I don't know if our parents had the same conversations. We grew up with it. And so it's almost background noise to us. And so sometimes I think just remembering it, listening to podcasts like this one, having conversations like this with your friends, and figuring out ways to change your own behavior can just have a massive impact.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no question that government policy is going to have to play a role. Business has to play a role, and business is coming around big time on climate change. But it's also going to come down to individuals making better decisions.
And voting, because we can have an effect on government policy.
Absolutely.
Our effect can be stronger than that of the lobbyists if we actually fucking go to the polls and we vote not just in the general, but in all of our local elections, in, you know, in when we're trying to put new people in the Senate, new people in the House, when we're trying to put new like state senators in place. Like, this is where this change is made.
Definitely.
Anytime in California, we vote by a ballot initiative, which is a fucking stupid system, but going out and voting and making sure that you understand what you're voting for.
Yeah.
And
it's not always voting for the Democrat or voting.
No.
There's
sometimes these are conservative.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there's actually growing movement within the Republican Party. It's small, but it's growing rapidly. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a Republican Climate Caucus that's going on now. The Citizens Climate Lobby is working very closely with them. You're seeing movement within the Republican Party. There are candidates out there who are on the side of, yeah, climate change is real. Yes, it's a problem. Yes, we can do something about it. Vote for them.
Yeah.
If you're a Republican, pay attention to this. This is something that impacts you. It impacts your kids. It's going to impact their kids. Vote for the people who represent your best interests and your family and your community and your state and your nation's best interest.
And if you're a Democrat, your representatives' hands are not fucking clean. The oil lobby is everywhere, and it is bipartisan. Believe you me. I mean, you were just talking about Hillary Clinton. Bernie talks about it all the time, obviously, but this is no new information. Like, you can look back decades and just as many, I don't know, I can't say that. I don't know if it's true that just as many, but a fuckload of Democratic politicians are taking lobbying money from
a
the oil industry.
A fuckload is the right term.
Yeah, fuckload. Yeah. It's on both sides of the aisle.
Absolutely.
I mean,
it's not a Republican thing.
No,
only.
It's not. They illustrate it so well in Veep.
Yeah.
Did you? I don't know if you watched. It was either last season or the season before when Julia Louis-Dreyfus's character is like at some sort of event and she's trying to get a law passed. And there's all this pork being added to it, and it keeps slipping in and out of the hands of the oil lobby. And she's like, fuck these guys, because she has to please them. It's like they control her whole candidacy. And she's a Democrat on the show.
Yeah, and you look at, again, getting back to Hillary Clinton, she's taking massive amounts of money from the fossil fuel industry. And so you look at some of these debates between Bernie Sanders and Hillary, and he asks her straight out, would you support a carbon tax? No, she won't.
Yeah,
you know, she supported fracking across the globe. She wouldn't put a ban on fracking. There's reasons why she won't do these things.
And now you're seeing, you know, universities, private organizations basically cutting ties with the fossil fuel industry to make a point, an activist point, you know, saying I'm as much as our university would love for you to pay for this thing that we want to have going on. It's immoral for us to take this money. Yeah, if we take this money, we're part of the problem.
The divestment movement is growing. There's sit-ins every day. Mm-hmm. There are college students sitting in their colleges right now fighting for divestment of fossil fuel investments in these colleges and universities. And not only is it the right moral thing to do, it's the right economic thing to do. You look at the coal industry, it's been decimated. You know, you look at the bankruptcies. It's a dinosaur. Yeah. It's done. We need to move beyond it. If you're invested in coal business, you're going to lose your fucking money. Yeah. And if your college or your organization is investing or anybody's investing in this, it's a bad decision. It's a bad economic decision.
It's true. Yeah, it doesn't have a lot of long-term staying power. I need to go back through all of my mutual funds and make sure none of them, you know, it's
hard
to
get all out of there.
Yeah. Cause it's everywhere. Your mutual funds kind of have so many different things in them. I need to make sure that I'm only buying clean funds in my SEP IRA. Absolutely.
One thing you said earlier, just to tie back.
Yeah.
You had mentioned that this conversation was moving kind of in a positive direction. You know, we start with the climate denial and kind of attacking all these points and we're moving into more solution-based. My goal would be to not do my website, not do my my blog or anything else anymore. If I can shut down fight climate denial, that would be my end goal. Because then I could move on to discuss solutions and where we move from here. Yeah. And I actually see that. I see that not too far in the future. The country is starting to get more better informed. The political nature of this discussion, while it's still political, people are starting to come to the center and realizing this shouldn't be a political discussion. Mm. This is a science. It's a morality discussion.
Yeah, and when people say it's not real at all, it's just a hoax, it's becoming more laughable. Yeah. You don't hear it in the general population as often. And when you do have politicians say it, there's 50 million articles written about it. There's, satire made about it. You see political cartoons made about it because it's embarrassing.
Yeah.
It's getting to be embarrassing.
Yeah. And there's still, you know, you look at the general population, I think it's something about 15% of people either don't believe in climate change or don't believe it's man-made. Mm-hmm. That's a much smaller number than it was before.
It's also the minority.
It's
so if we actually were voting, you know, for our interests in this issue, I think we could see a lot of change affected. We just need to make sure that the politicians are getting things on the ballot that we want to be able to vote for.
Yep.
And unfortunately, that's not going to happen until the lobbies start to lose a little bit of their stranglehold there. But they're slowly dying and choking off. So
they're going to be around for a while, but what's really going to drive it is when people stop electing politicians who don't believe in climate change.
Yeah, that's true.
When they start paying at the polls and when they start paying at the ballot box, that's when this will really change. And we're not that far away from it at this point. I mean, you look at some of the events that have been happening in this country, you just can't get away from the fact that the storms are stronger, they're more powerful, they're more frequent. We have these 100-year storms that are happening 2-3 times a year.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't going to go away. It's just going to get worse. And at a certain point, these political arguments are just going to have no meaning anymore. It's like you can say you don't believe in it, but my fucking house just got washed away.
Yeah.
You know, or the area where I'm living in, we've run out of water. We have to move away from here. We have to shut down our farm. We can't do what we're doing because climate change has ruined the area that we're in. This is us. This is what we are responsible for, from individual action to government action and everything in between. We need to start taking action across the board. And politics is a big, big part of it. You know, we need to elect officials who can stand up against the lobbyists, who aren't corrupt by their money, mm-hmm. by their campaign contributions. As soon as they're taking money from these groups, they're going to pay them back.
They have to.
They have to pay them back.
That's the arrangement. That's exactly what lobbying is.
Yeah, these groups do not invest tens or hundreds of millions of dollars in these campaigns because they think it's the right thing to do.
No,
or the
they
moral
do it because they want
do.
Their back scratched when legislation comes out that's not going to happen in their favor.
Yeah. It'll always happen.
Always. So listen, Ben, I think that's a really good note to end on. But before we end, I was struggling with whether or not I wanted to close out with the last two questions with you because they might be redundant. Because probably the most popular answer to my final two questions has to do with climate change. Maybe you go that route, maybe you don't. But I close every podcast asking my guests two things. The first one is the more kind of morose question, which is when you're looking to the future in whatever context that matters to you, it could be personal, it could be global, anywhere in between, what is the thing that you are most concerned about? What's the thing that keeps you up the most at night? And then on the flip side of that, what are you most optimistic and hopeful for?
To be honest, they both do fall into climate change. I'm most concerned that, not that we won't act, because I know deep down inside we will act. Mm-hmm. It's a question of will we act boldly enough and fast enough? And will there be the ability to push through the obstruction fast enough? And that's a big question mark. There's a lot of scientists out there who really look at the data and really look at the potential of what could happen. And if you don't mind, can I jump into a quick thing?
Yeah, of course.
Positive feedback loops. Mm-hmm. We didn't get into this, but it's something that's really important when you talk about what could go really fucking wrong, really fucking fast. One example of a positive feedback loop would be, all right, the climate is warming. When the climate warms, ice and snow, it melts, right? Mm-hmm. Normally, when sunlight hits the earth, it largely reflects off of snow and ice, and it goes back into space. Some of it, of course, gets caught in the troposphere, but a lot of it exits back out into space. If that ice is gone or that snow is gone, what's underneath it? Dark earth.
Dark land.
Or dark water. Mm-hmm. And as we all know, if you're wearing a white t-shirt or a black t-shirt out in the sun, that black t-shirt absorbs a lot of energy. The white one reflects a lot of energy. Real simple stuff. Same thing here. So the ice melts. Mm-hmm. Now the earth is absorbing more heat, which warms up the earth, which causes more snow to melt, which absorbs more heat, and it continues to spiral. That's a positive feedback loop. And not only do you have that one, you have ones like forest fires.
Yeah.
As you hit a drought condition and trees are drying out, and you have extreme heat, you have these forest fires, those are going to then emit more carbon into the atmosphere, not only from the trees, but all the vegetation that's on the forest floor. That by itself is also going to impact a carbon sink. Forests are carbon sinks. On top of that, the soot goes up into the atmosphere and it comes eventually down, and sometimes it lands on snow and ice, which darkens the snow and ice, which causes it to melt faster. And this turns into this massive positive feedback loop. So there's this fear out there in the scientific community, and it's very hard to put numbers to it because nobody really knows how this is going to work out.
Yeah,
but there's
we talk
this
about
fear.
The tipping point
yep,
a lot.
That's exactly it.
It's a bit arbitrary, but it's like the point at which it's the event horizon.
Yep.
It's like the point that we almost can't come back from.
And we know we don't know anything, but we believe, science believes, that we still are within a range where we can control the outcome to a particular extent. Mm-hmm. But we also know that there's this murky gray area, and it could be 2 years, it could be 20 years, it could be 50 years, where we will hit that tipping point, and then it will be outside of our control. There
and
will
we know
be
we're
nothing
approaching it.
Else we can do.
No matter how long it takes, we're on a dead forward path towards it. We're not moving away from it right now.
Yeah. So
that's
coming
horrifying.
Back to your question, the thing I'm most terrified about
yeah.
is that we are nudging up to a tipping point and we don't even know it. And most people don't even believe that there's a problem. I'm sorry. There are some people who don't even believe that there's a problem.
Do you have anything happy for me? is there anything you're looking forward to?
Yeah, absolutely. The happy side is that I do believe in human ingenuity, mm-hmm. and I do believe that we are an extremely adaptable species, and we're problem solvers, you know? So I believe at the core of me that we're going to attack this problem, we're going to come out, and we're going to win. It's going to be hard. We have to have people fighting. We need you fighting. We need you broadcasting. We need everybody listening today to be out there. And it doesn't have to be the big fight. You don't have to be creating websites or writing blogs or any of that. It can be the small communications. It can be those small individual actions. But I believe in people. I believe in humanity. I believe that we're more good than we are bad, and that we will rally around this cause. So I think we're going to get there. I truly do.
And I appreciate so much the good fight that you are fighting. Guys, I want you to visit fightclimatedenial.com. You can read Ben's blog. You can see, answers to common arguments. There's a lot of great places that he also links out to so that you can see more resources there. Can people find you in other ways other than on the blog?
Yeah, absolutely. The website's kind of a work in progress. Started it only maybe less than a year ago.
Oh, wow.
My Tumblr site is actually quite a bit better. So fightclimatedenial.tumblr.com. I'm also on Twitter, fightdenial. And then my Facebook, I kind of keep that personal.
Gotcha. That's like my Instagram.
There you go.
My Instagram is private. It's not actually private. You can follow it, but it's all like pictures of my dog. So there's no science. I actually got a comment from somebody that was like, I'm so glad I follow a science communicator who never communicates science. And I was like, bitch, go to any of my other outlets. Like, can I have one thing that's just like Doritos and my dog? But it's good. It's good to have boundaries.
Absolutely.
Well, guys, yeah. Hit up Ben, check out his work, say hello on the interwebs. Ben, thank you so much for joining me. This was such a blast, and I absolutely learned a lot.
It's been a pleasure. I'd love to come back and do it again.
Awesome. And guys, thank you so much for coming back week after week. I'm looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.